On This Week in Enterprise Tech, the FCC gets stuck in the slow lane, radios get cognitive, and disaster recovery with a broomstick. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 91, recorded May 12, 2014. Disaster recovery with a broomstick. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LegalZoom. Visit LegalZoom.com to save on your legal needs and gain access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. LegalZoom is not a law firm, but provides self-help services at your specific direction. Visit LegalZoom.com and use offer code ENTERPRISE to receive $10 off at checkout. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace which connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Amazon.com gift card when you get a loan. And by RingCentral. The cloud-based phone system we use just got better with the launch of Meetings, the full-service video conference feature. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral starts at under $25 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballister, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I'm joined by my regular all-star cast, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii, who is holding up a thing. Brian, explain.
This is actually a start of a dodecahedron speaker, but I'm having fun playing with the new MakerBot Replicator Generation 5, but unfortunately, I have to reboot it 10 times to get it to get a DHCP address. MakerBot, I love the little Star Trek-y sounds, but please fix that.
MakerBot, there's nothing worse than a sad Uber network geek. Now, someone who's probably not playing with the MakerBot is our other good friend, Mr. Curtis Franklin of Enterprise Efficiency off on the left coast of the country. Curtis, how are you today?
Doing quite well, Padre. Have good weather, and thanks to an electrician visit earlier today, plenty of electricity, which is a good thing. So glad to be here with the Twyatt Riot.
Indeed. As the summer season approaches, it's always good to keep your cool. Now, gentlemen, let's get right in to the blips. Mine is something that I personally just find hilarious. NeoCity wants to remind the FCC why a fast lane for the internet is a bad, bad, bad idea. So they're throttling all of the FCC's IP addresses to modem speeds. That's right. Kyle Drake of NeoCities put up a blog post explaining how he has added a script to their servers to slow down any computer using one of the IP addresses currently registered to the FCC. The script will automatically throttle those computers to 28.8 kilobits per second. That's old school modem speeds. Not cutting off their access, but essentially moving them to the slow lane. Now, they've sent an open letter to the FCC saying that they'd be happy to remove the limits if the FCC is willing to pay a $1,000 per year fast lane charge. Of note is that all of these actions are perfectly in line with the new FCC guidelines on net neutrality. Now, though NeoCities isn't a huge source of traffic, they've made public the code that they've used to throttle the FCC, and they hope that other system administrators will do the same until the FCC feels our pain.
Well, my blip has to do with the FBI and the rules change they're looking for in how search warrants are issued to let them hack your bot-infested PC. See, the FBI has submitted a proposal that would change two important things. One of them is the way jurisdictions are run. Right now, judges tend to issue warrants only in their jurisdiction. The FBI would like to broaden that net a little bit. The other is that right now, if a warrant is issued, they have to let you know, generally via paper placed in your hand by another human being, one way or another, they would like to be allowed to email you a notice or just have it pop up on a computer that they are hacking into. Now, the FBI says that both of these would help them fight botnets, especially in those cases where they don't know precisely where a computer is located or that computer's address has been obfuscated by one technique or another. Of course, the civil libertarians say that it would allow the FBI to do judge shopping to get any warrant a little bit more easily. And boy, oh boy, can't you just imagine the spam and phishing opportunities if a legitimate email or pop-up notice could come from the FBI? Pros and cons, but this is just a proposal right now in front of a meeting that's going to happen on May 29th. Keep watching to see what might be happening between the FBI and your favorite bot-infested computer.
Well, mine comes from CNET, and thank you for Stephen Musil for breaking this. He's saying that iOS 7 is repeatedly not encrypting email attachments. Security researcher Andreas Kurtz wrote in a blog post that he discovered a few weeks ago that attachments stored in mobile.mail, the mobile.mail app in iOS 7.04, 7.1, and 7.11 were not adequately secured by Apple's data protection mechanisms. He further reported that some very standard break-in methods, including device firmware upgrade mode, which allows devices to be restored from any state by plugging them into a computer, he was able to gain access to the device file system. The moral of the story is that for now, don't attach that Bitcoin to an email sent via iOS 7.
That's right, and that's the end of the Enterprise Blip. Now, when we come back, we're going to be covering a few stories, including talking about how DARPA is trying to give you the hotspot of your dreams using drones. But until then, let's take a little bit of time to thank the first sponsor of the Twiat Riot, and that's LegalZoom.com. Now, modern technology is great. We all have smartphones, we have iPads and other gadgets that make it easy to do so many things. But with all this tech, why is it that we seem to be spending more and more time doing the mundane tasks that we really would prefer not to do? Maybe it's because even though we're surrounded by technology, we're surrounded by these services, they don't work the way that we need them to work. Instead, they ask that we change the way that we think, the way that we work, the way that we process in order to get things done. Well, that's why we've got LegalZoom, because LegalZoom understands that. That's why when it comes to getting the legal help that you need, LegalZoom provides a great solution that works with your busy schedule, with the way that you want to work. Now, let's face it, the legal system is complicated. There are better things that you can do with that time. So LegalZoom is there to get that time back for you. If you're thinking about starting a business, forming an LLC, getting a trademark, having a will or living trust drawn up, LegalZoom gets the job done right. You'll get the personal attention that you need, and they'll help you take care of all the details. LegalZoom provides legal help through independent attorneys and self-help services, but it's not a law firm, and that's really what makes it different. LegalZoom's been helping families and small businesses for over 14 years, and they received an A-plus from the Better Business Bureau. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to stop wasting your time. We want you to stop jumping from site to site, service to service, trying to hodgepodge together all the legal help you need. Instead, just go to one place that gets all your legal help done in the way that you need it done. Visit LegalZoom.com today and use the offer code ENTERPRISE to save on your legal needs and also get access to a network of legal plan attorneys for guidance. Don't put off the things that you need to do. Go to LegalZoom.com right now and use offer code ENTERPRISE. That's LegalZoom.com, offer code ENTERPRISE to receive $10 off at checkout. And we thank LegalZoom for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Gentlemen, let's get to the Enterprise Bite. The first one has got me kind of giggling. Now, DARPA tech has been known for being associated with one of the most fearsome military machines in the world. The machine that can get you at any time, any place, anywhere with pretty much any device. So now that fearsome machinery is going to be turned to getting you better internet. That's right. The aerial branch of the United States Armed Forces is investing $2.7 million over the next 4 years with computer science researchers at the University of Buffalo to develop
cognitive radio. Now, cognitive radio isn't new. It's something that we've been playing with for a while. The idea is to create a system of communications that can jump spectrum, that can jump protocols. In other words, that can reconfigure itself on the fly to get the best possible communication at any given moment. Now, cognitive radio is a form of wireless, but it shouldn't just be considered another standard. Each radio is constantly adjusting its power, its frequency, its network protocols, and jumping away from interference and congested spectrum. Now, in theory, cognitive radio would make the entire spectrum available to all communication devices at the same time, giving it a massive amount of bandwidth. Chibert, I want to throw this over to you first. We've been big proponents of this idea of the efficient use of spectrum. And, you know, whenever we have this discussion on whether or not wireless will replace wired, there's always this sort of stop moment and say, wait a minute. If the physics of wireless radio isn't going to allow you to use it as efficiently as you think. But if we were actually able to develop cognitive radio to its fullest potential and have a true frequency agile protocol agile technology, then we could get pretty close to 100% usage of RF, right?
Yeah, sure. No.
Okay, there we go. Thank you.
No, the real problem is this isn't going to apply to anyone but the military. The biggest reason is the FCC says what you can and cannot use within the spectrum. And the only time there's even a little bit of wiggle room is if you're a ham operator, and only ham operators of a certain level. I'll leave that for Kurt. But the reality is such technologies have been around for a very, very long time, and they've just been artificially constricted down to what bands they're allowed to use because they need to, you know, coexist with other technologies. But in a war zone, those rules kind of go out the window. And if we had the entire spectrum to play with, oh man, I could move data around like you wouldn't believe. In fact, combine that with something like a digital fountain, and you could have a mobile command center running 3D HD anywhere you want. There's a lot of possibilities, but it needs to play with other people when it's in a civilian arena.
Now, Curtis, we understand why the military would be interested in this type of technology, because you're talking about instant high speed, nearly unjammable wireless communications. I mean, any form of jamming that uses traditional throw RF energy up in the sky and hopefully it kills signals would be ineffective against a technology that could jump away to different frequencies and to different protocols that could be more error resistant. But let me ask you this. If we were to combine this technology with what the military also says they'll be doing with older drones, using the older Predator drones to hold these new cognitive radio sets, isn't that a good use of RF spectrum? I mean, instantly deployable networks as we need them, it transcends battlefields. I mean, what Chibert seems to be saying is that, yeah, this technology is interesting, but it'll only work on a battlefield. I'd say this would work with something like Project Loon or any of the other initiatives that some major technology companies are trying to do with drones, with balloons, with high altitude observables.
Oh, absolutely. I think that you have a lot of opportunity here for any place where you're trying to get better, more reliable wireless communications. And there are some obvious places that don't necessarily have to do with letting some yuppie check their email more efficiently while they're at Starbucks. I know that in the developing world, this is a huge issue and has been for a long time. I gave a speech to the World Bank a number of years ago where we were talking about communications methods for those areas of Africa where you might have power, you might have connectivity, but you rarely have both at the same time. If you could allow some technology to bring more consistent wireless communications to those areas, then all of a sudden the implications for healthcare, for education, for governance, as well as for all of the commercial aspects become huge. I think this is one where most of the enterprise world is happy to let the military pay the freight for the early development. Of course, at the same time, you do have those companies like Amazon, like Google, who are also investing. It's a really exciting time as we're looking in software-defined radio, one of those areas where the FCC is allowing a fair amount of experimentation. And I genuinely believe that sometime in the next 5 years, we are likely to see some genuine breakthroughs in what's available to allow much more resilient, much more bandwidth efficient RF communications.
We've got some decent comments in the chat room. One from Washington Wisps, WA Wisps, who said that DFS, dynamic frequency selection, on 5 gigahertz uses this concept today, and it works pretty well. And we've got Tech Jedi, who is humorously saying, well, you know, what would you use this kind of a network for? We don't really need that much bandwidth. It's more than just frequency agile radio. You have to remember that cognitive radio at its foundation is this idea of having a network of radios that are aware of one another and can intelligently decide where you set power levels, which radios use which frequencies and which radios use which protocols in order to maximize the amount of bandwidth. It's a self-healing network. That's the reason why I find it so exciting. That's the reason why I find it so promising, which is imagine a radio that would be smart enough to know when it should turn its power up or down or use a different type of protocol or a different set of frequencies in order to play nice with the radio next door. That's the kind of stuff that actually could lead us to that wireless mesh that was promised so long ago. Not to mention that it could also help us to bypass a lot of the telco nastiness. But let's bypass that into our next Enterprise Byte, talking about InBloom. It's a cautionary tale for big data. Now, you probably haven't heard about InBloom unless you're running around in the education technology circles. It came out with a big splash. The idea was, wait a minute, we could use big data. We could use all these data points being collected about students to custom tailor an education to them. Sounds good so far, right? I mean, we want a custom tailor education. Here's where they ran into problem. InBloom was a startup that wanted to customize that education, but they didn't really put any thought into what they could do with all the extra data that came along with those data points. They raised $100 million from some of the biggest hitters in education, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundations, as well as the Carnegie Corporation. Now, after just 15 months of operation, they're closing their doors after a massive outcry about privacy issues. Now, the company ran into opposition from both privacy and parent groups. There were concerns about how outside vendors might use some of the data that was being collected by InBloom. Things like the student's disability status or any sort of information about how they had been behaving in school. Just a few weeks ago, the New York State Legislature passed a law prohibiting state educational organizations from releasing their information to database companies like InBloom, and that effectively killed the project. I want to go over to you first, Curtis, because this is an interesting test case for big data, a company that was trying to do good things. I mean, their stated goals, I think a lot of people would agree that it's better to have an educational system that pays attention to the needs, the particular needs of a student. But in this case, the threat of what big data could be used for trumped any potential benefits the program could have had. Is this a singular case in which big data goes bad, or are we going to see this more and more as people kind of freak out about how much data about them is available publicly?
While I'm not intimately familiar with them, I think there are two issues that probably were at the core of their problems. One is one that we've talked about here on Twiat before, and that's the perceived value of what you're getting in return for your personal information. And I suspect that they weren't allowed to make a really good case about the value of that information versus the value that they would be returning in terms of the education. Right now, a lot of people are very reluctant to see instantly the benefit of a new educational program. You really have to be careful about how you define those benefits and how you communicate the benefits. The other thing is that they were trying to go after the public schools, and you get the whole opt-in, opt-out question going. My suspicion is if they had targeted charter schools or private schools first, they might well have had much less of an outcry because those families have already opted into an additional level of scrutiny and control for their children. They see the benefit of that and they're willing to do it. When you get into the public schools where there are different levels of understanding about what goes on, different levels of caring about education, it gets much more difficult to make a blanket case about what you're doing. So I think that there are some lessons that are applicable. Once again, being very careful about the benefits you're returning versus the value of the information you're taking, and getting the whole opt-in, opt-out thing right, making sure that people never, ever feel that this is a case of Big Brother storming in and stomping all over their rights.
I want to throw this over to you, Cheever, because your wife, Kathy Chi, in the chat room makes a really good point about in the educational system, there is too much paranoia about what can be released. I think the education system and the healthcare system are two parts of society in general that we get ultra paranoid anytime someone talks about tapping into those big data points, because there's a lot of data contained in those databases. But let me ask you this. Do you think maybe there would have been a different response if instead of this heavy-handed, we're going to go to the schools and ask for their databases, they would open up a service and say, look, we're going to be like Facebook for your child's education. Give us as much information as you think you can give us, and we will build a curriculum around it, knowing that the more information you give us, the better the curriculum is going to be.
Yeah, totally. What these guys probably really and truly forgot was the FERPA regulations, which govern the privacy issues of underage students. Heck, it even also pertains to college students. If someone goes and does something silly, like we had once long ago, someone had a database that had Social Security numbers in it, the parents went crazy. They actually started a class action suit, and the university in question ended up having to pay some amazingly huge fines. I totally agree. It needs to be opt-in. You know, Curtis has hit the nail right on the head. The parents need to give the permission. FERPA does not allow the institution to give this permission, and that's where these guys really made their mistake. Parents, if you are dealing with minors, parents have to be involved. Parents have to say yes, and they had better darn well get it in writing to protect their behind. Privacy issues are a very, very big deal when it comes to minors. And our general public, if you go and do something stupid to a minor child, you will be crucified. And I'm afraid In Bloom found that out the hard way.
Yep, don't mess with our children's data. Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking about protecting some of that educational data. Now, Cheebert, there's been a story that I've been wanting to bring onto the show since we started This Week in Enterprise Tech. It deals with your campus, right? I mean, we're talking about what happens when a major disaster hits a research institution and they don't have proper backups.
Oh, yeah. Halloween 2004.
Okay, leave it there. Let's tease them. Halloween 2004, that gives people time to go to Google and look for the University of Hawaii, the flood of Halloween 2004. But before we get there, I thought now might be a good time to talk about the second sponsor of the Twilight Riot, and that's Prosper. Now, what would you do if I told you that in 72 hours you could have $35,000 to cover your needs? What would you do with that money? Would you pay off your high-interest credit card debt? Would you finally do that home improvement project that you've been waiting to do? Would you start a new business? Well, no matter what you do with the money, the question becomes, how do you get it? Would you attempt to get it if I told you that applying for that loan was as easy as filling out a couple of forms online, all without ever stepping foot into a bank? Well, I know it sounds like a dream, but it's not a dream, folks. That's Prosper. Prosper is an innovative peer-to-peer lending process, Silicon Valley's answer to a more modern, community-based personal loan. There are no outrageous fees, no raising interest rates, and yes, you'll never set foot in a bank. While Prosper offers low fixed rates unsecured personal loans, which means no collateral required, and has multi-year terms available. Prosper has more than 2 million members, lenders, and borrowers, and over $1 billion in funded loans. Folks, this is peer-to-peer lending. Now, we've heard of programs like this, normally in cute stories about micropayment systems overseas, but it's time that Prosper and peer-to-peer lending made its way into our financial reality. Prosper connects people who need money with those who have it to loan. It's really that simple. Just go to prosper.com/twit to check your rate instantly without affecting your credit score. Now, here's what we want you to do. If you are in need of a loan, if you want to try something that's a little different than going to a mega bank and going with your hat in hand, asking them for some money, try Prosper. For a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit viewers a $50 Amazon.com gift card when you get a loan. Go to prosper.com/twit. That's a special site set up just for our viewers. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days. And receive a $50 Amazon.com gift card when you get a loan. Prosper.com is not affiliated with Amazon. For gift card details, visit prosper.com/twit. That's prosper.com/twit. And we thank Prosper for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let's get to it. We welcome to the show a representative of both Synology and IOSafe, Mr. Thad Weil. Thank you so very much for coming on to the show, Thad.
Thank you for having me.
Now, it's been a while since I saw you. The last time I saw you, I believe you were at the IOSafe / Synology booth at Digital Experience CES 2014.
Correct. And there was an interesting Wizard of Oz theme going on. Yes.
Yeah, we got footage from that. That was different. That was definitely different.
Was eyebrow arching. I didn't get it, but hey.
The Wicked Witch running around handing out USB sticks and lollipops. That was the one that just, I was like, I don't know if I should be here.
Synergy of, over my head.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Now, we brought you on because on the show, we've been a big fan of IOSafe. We've seen their products time and time again.
Oh, yeah.
I've reviewed them on Before You Buy. We've seen them here on This Week in Enterprise Tech. I've shown them off on Know How and Padres Corner just because it's an interesting solution. They disaster-proof storage. Now, they've partnered with Synology because Synology also offers some ultra-high-performance network solutions.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And actually, I mean, as far as I know, they have the closest partnership with Synology of any company. They not only use our logic boards, but they are also the only company that I'm aware of that's privy to our operating system.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, they really do have our product, but they make it awesomer.
Right. Jason, if you could go ahead and just run that B-roll, just to show, you have to run it without the audio, by the way, just to show you what we're talking about. Whenever we've looked at IOSafe products, this is the N2, which has actually been supplanted by a faster version, that we're talking about putting a NAS or some sort of storage system into a device that can basically withstand anything. They're fireproof. They're crushproof. They're waterproof. You can toss them. You can blast them. In fact, I believe that's right. We rolled over one of these enclosures. Oh, yeah, we shot one with a shotgun and we electrify them. These are the devices that are truly designed to stand up to pretty much any abuse that you can toss at them. But, of course, they needed to partner with a company like Synology in order to make sure that they could get decent performance out of it. Now, the reason why we brought you on is because IOSafe and Synology, in your partnership, you have just released, and you're now really pushing this, mm-hmm. this set of rack-mounted units, correct?
Well, okay, so as I understand it, IOSafe is going to be launching the 1513 Plus, I think early July. And that is going to have available, or it's in the pipeline, rack-mounted peripherals that enable you to, you know, load it onto, I would imagine, like a 3 or a 4U bay.
Right.
But that's taking their awesome new 1513 Plus, and essentially, I have to imagine it's going on its side, but I'm just guessing there.
Yeah. Thad, let's take a step back because our audience, and I love our audience, but they get really, really antsy anytime they feel like someone's making an elevator pitch.
Okay.
What you're here for is you're here to help mm-hmm. us get some of the basics, some of the best practices about data storage, data recovery, and disaster preparedness. We've covered this on Twit before, but it never hurts to hear it again and again and again. Now, tell us, in the simplest terms you can imagine, what are some of the things that you absolutely need to do in the enterprise if you want to safeguard your data?
Well, you definitely need to. The rule of threes applies in the enterprise space. You want to have a copy that you're actively using, a backup, and then a backup on in a remote location. With the IonSafe solution, it seems like you can actually probably obviate the third solution because the one of the things you're trying to protect by having off-campus storage is fire. Is flooding,
right.
And the IonSafe product actually does accommodates that in one box, so you can have your active storage and your backup. And I think that is starting to sound a little elevator pitchy. Still,
that's okay. We'll back it off. Let me ask you this: in your experience in the channel, because I've experienced this a lot from the IT side, I get people who still, for some reason, think that because they have data on a RAID array.
Yeah.
That's backed up.
Right.
And I can't figure out why that is. Do you experience that a lot?
Oh, yes. There are very few shows we go to that we actually encounter people that know the distinction between RAID and backup. So RAID is a level of fault tolerance. It covers drive failure. It does not cover the loss of data, which is why you want to have a backup. And backup, as a clarification, is not an external drive that you have attached to your computer that you load additional information onto. Backup is making an eidetic copy of your active drive onto a remote drive so that if something happens on your primary work drives, you have an exact backup of your projects available so you sort of reduce the downtime threshold there. And a lot of people are kind of... they are in that sort of assessment where they think that an external drive is backup, even if you're just putting new stuff onto it. Not the case.
Not the case, yeah.
Yeah.
Curtis, let me throw this over to you because you could give us some of the executive, the enterprise view of the problem. The conversation I was having with Thad was this idea that a lot of people have that redundancy is your backup, that somehow having a RAID array, an array that's fault tolerant, is the only backup that you need. And it's strange because even in 2014, I'm still meeting executives, CTOs, CIOs, people who should know better, who if I ask them what their backup is, they'll say, well, we've got a NAS array down in the basement. Do you see that a lot? Have you covered any of that on Enterprise Efficiency?
We have covered it some, and you do see that. Now, in fairness, I tend not to see it in the CIOs of the very largest companies. You also tend not to see it in two other populations. One are CIOs where their company deals with very critical data, healthcare, things like that. The other is CIOs who have been bitten by a device failure. Because as we all know, having all of your data in one physical location, whether it is a RAID structure or not, makes it vulnerable to any number of things that can happen to that system. That's the real genius of backup, the fact that you can take the data and put it somewhere else. There's nothing worse than talking to someone who has had their RAID system destroyed by a fire. Here in Florida, hurricanes are non-trivial events. Other places have earthquakes. I remember there were a ton of stories coming out of Hurricane Katrina about companies that had in their minds done all the right things and then had their entire data infrastructure float off into the Gulf of Mexico. So teaching them can be important, especially for the small to medium-sized CIOs and those of slightly larger companies that just don't see the benefit. And, let's be fair, there are a lot of salespeople who have come through touting a NAS solution, touting a RAID solution, who have, if not said specifically, heavily implied that if you have one of their systems, then all of that expensive backup stuff can safely go away. So the industry bears some responsibility, but in general, a little bit of education can save an awful lot of heartache.
Right. Brian, let me throw that over to you, because actually Curtis brought up a point that I think is absolutely vital. That is that there have been some vendors. I've received these pitches who seem to intimate that, oh, yeah, so if you've got this covers all your backups. This one system, which also acts as your primary system, it will never go down. It will never be destroyed. It's completely disaster-proof. And so you can remove all the cost of having off-site backup or having even by-site backup. You must have run into this in your IT journals, yes? Jibbert?
Sorry. You didn't say who it was. No, yeah, totally. I've had it time and time and time again. People keep saying, oh, yeah, back it up on the same physical unit, and then the power supply blows up and you've got nothing. Mm-hmm. Because when the power supply blows up, it typically takes some drives with it. Fun and games. I actually want to go a little further. I was actually setting up an audit for a health research project not too long ago. And to do that, I had to go and read all the regulations from the Department of Health and Human Services. HHR actually has regulations that you as a researcher must do, and that is offsite backup. Not only offsite backup, but they also specify going down as far as making sure you're implementing something along the towers of Hanoi so that you don't have all your eggs in one basket. You know, do an incremental, but do a couple of fulls and keep multiple iterations so that if some idiot goes and says, oh, you know, I forgot, I deleted that really, really important research file last week, you can still come back. Backup is more than just restoring from a disaster. It's also restoring from idiocy.
Got it. Thad, let me throw this at you. We've got a great chat room here at TV, and they've got some really good questions. And some of them are coming from Max1234 and NervD and a few of the others. Sorry if I'm not mentioning your names, guys. But they have this interesting question about multi-terabyte backups. When a lot of these best practices were made, especially the ones when the cloud was first coming along, they were saying, oh, just push it off-site, push it up into the cloud. But what do you do if you've got a 30-terabyte installation? What do you do if you've got a 100-terabyte installation? What kind of installations that you see require that vast amount of storage and at the same time bi-located disaster recovery, disaster-resistant storage?
Sure. So, first, before I answer that question, I just want to backtrack a little bit and say that even the people at IOSAFE would not say, because of their product, forget the three steps of storage. That was me throwing that out. Right. But it is you can now actually, you can go about backing up volumes of storage in a couple of different ways. You can create an identical volume locally and then put it off in a remote location and then have the current version continually back up to the offsite version. And that can sort of mitigate the volume of storage. There's also bidirectional synchronization. So you could use, in the Synology world, Cloud Sync and have one disk station have multiple disk stations sync with each other. And that can happen without any intermediation by, it's essentially set it up and forget it. But there, I guess it just kind of, I'm not really answering the question very well, but it just depends on how you kind of want to do it. If the volume of storage does turn over quite a bit, we have people that will actually write to their backup NAS and then pull those drives and then ship them off to a lockbox someplace and then put in a new array of drives. It's dynamic.
Right. I mean, yeah. No, I understand. this is one of the things that happens as you get up into a lot of storage, because no matter how you slice it, moving 30 terabytes of data is not going to be easy. I mean, you're talking about a lot of hardware that you're moving from place to place. But as you said, you know, one of the things that you can do with Synology products, and this is one of the reasons why I've moved pretty much all of my ready NASs over to Synology, is they got really, really good syncing between arrays. So, like, for example, we just did a setup which theoretically does the 3-2-1, but not really. It used two sets of IOSafe arrays, but two of those sets were in the same building, just different parts of the building, so that if there was a disaster, one of them would probably survive. And both of those synced up to a third array that was in a colo. Now, we felt comfortable doing that because we were fairly confident that at least one of the arrays would survive a disaster. We also felt that because it would only do periodic syncing, we weren't going to be overusing our connection to the internet. And because the two arrays were in the same building, it also meant we got crazy fast data transfer for anyone who was actually on campus.
Sure.
I think that this is where I want to get your input.
Sure.
Is this the new face of the 3-2-1 where we really, not only are we moving around a crap ton of data, but we also need to create systems that allow us to access them in a timely fashion?
Yeah, no, and that's very true. I mean, speed is becoming more and more germane as each year passes. And, you know, having two servers on site locally, you know, sharing between each other for that fast access makes an awful lot of sense for a lot of workflows. And it's going to get, because of 4K, actually, 4K and 8K, those are actually pushing sort of bandwidth, the needs for higher bandwidth, higher throughput, even faster than I think a lot of companies were maybe expecting they would. And of course, because these are large volume files, or if we're talking in enterprise space databases, which can be hundreds of gigabytes, they can be terabytes of data, they need to be accessed very quickly. The turnover needs to be fast. And I guess that's where I would throw in something like solid state caching, you know, read caching, right, or read write caching to help mitigate some of the latency there of the disk based medium.
No. Here, how about this? I want to give you something that you can think about for a while. We're going to be going to break in just a second here, but if you could imagine, let's take a small to medium business. Let's even back away from the enterprise, okay? So something that's going to be using Synology drives, something that maybe could use a couple of IOSafe arrays. I'd like you to design your perfect storage network. Let's say, give me 10 terabytes. What would you design to maximize durability, disaster recovery, and performance? And I'll leave you with that. Now, when we do come back, I want to start off with Chibert. He's going to be telling us all about his disaster recovery nightmare that occurred in that Halloween flood of 2004. But before we get there, we got to say thank you to the last sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. You know him, you love him. It's RingCentral. Now, when we built this studio, we decided to, dog food. We wanted to put as much as possible into the cloud because we had been telling our audience to put everything in the cloud. So that's why our scheduling is in the cloud. Our document sharing is in the cloud. Our email is in the cloud. So when Russell, our IT guy, came to us and told us that we could have a full-featured PBX in the cloud without any bulky hardware in the studio or wires running to different parts of the workspace or a dedicated work person to handle all the changes we have to make to the PBX, well, folks, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain, and now RingCentral has launched Meetings. So in addition to all that we love about RingCentral, receiving voicemails through our email, sending and receiving fax messages from our smartphones, the auto receptionist who greets our callers and announces employees and department extensions, well, now with Meetings, we can host face-to-face meetings in high definition and share desktop or documents with anyone, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Meetings makes RingCentral the single best business solution on the market today. Now, here's what we're hoping the Twiat Riot will do. We hope that you will see if RingCentral might be the solution for your small to medium business. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing under $25 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. One more time, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use their promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT, and we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to the disaster, Chiebert. I was a young Jesuit when I first heard about this little story. You were actually on the campus, I believe, when this happened. You want to tell us about that fateful night, October 24, 2004?
Well, Sherman, let's set the Wayback Machine to Halloween 2004. It was a dark and stormy night. And what had happened was there was a couple weeks before, another large storm that dropped a whole bunch of trash into the Manoa Stream. Now, what happened was, being, you know, overtaxed and underfunded, the crew that was supposed to clean that out couldn't get to it. And Halloween rolled around with an amazing storm. We're talking close, I think it was close to 26 inches in 24 hours of rain. So what happened was the Manoa Stream overflowed its banks and went on its original stream bed, which roared through the University of Hawaii campus. We lost a whole bunch of stuff in this biomedical research facility. One gentleman was actually doing a Drosophila research project that he had been working on since he was a grad student, and he was just about ready to retire and pass the project to his grad students. It was a complete loss. Not only that, a lot of data was lost. I actually spent the day after using a broomstick, poking around in the mud, trying to find the servers and the backup tapes. The water that roared through Hamilton Library, the basement, was so strong, it actually tore open data safes. We actually had our backup tapes scattered all over the place, and some of the tapes were actually ground to dust. So even though there was backup, even though, you know, they were supposed to take the tapes home, they weren't. So, violation of the 3-2-1 rule. So anyway, we actually had a federal document repository in the basement of Hamilton Library. 3 miles away, we actually found some of those documents, some of those rare pictures. The amount of data lost was actually very staggering, and now one of the things we're starting to do is we're doing a lot of our student records onto IOSafe Solos in college offices. And we're starting to also use a combination of traditional Synology NASes and then using the sync to back up to an IOSafe someplace else, typically on another campus or potentially even on another island.
Now, Chiebert, see, this story actually started to change my mind about how we do the 3-2-1 backups. I remember the first time I heard about this, I believe, was in 2005. And then 2 years later, I actually was living on the campus of the University of Hawaii. And when I heard about how so many of the researchers had not been doing their federally mandated due diligence for backup disaster recovery, you know, taking things off site, I realized that even though it may sound like a good idea to take something off site, it probably would have been a better idea in that instance to have at least one or two different data repository devices that could have survived the disaster, so that if, and actually inevitably when, people didn't do their due diligence in taking backups off site, there was at least a chance to recover the data that was on site.
Yeah, very definitely. And I should point out, a lot of federal agencies, while they mandate due diligence, it really doesn't spell out anything specific. Health and Human Services was the very first agency I ever saw that actually spelled it out and said it has to exist in three places. So that's the first federal agency I've seen that actually spelled out, used the 3-2-1 rule. But now, yeah, lots of things. In fact, our home now has an IOSafe NAS. And what I'm actually going to be doing is taking the mounting kit and bolting it down to the foundation of my home, so that if, God forbid, my home should burn to the ground, even with the firemen using high-pressure water hoses, that NAS isn't going skittering off into the stream behind my home. I'll still be able to get to my old taxes. I'll still be able to get to my family pictures. And because it's a NAS, it's easy to store encrypted data on it.
Got it. Let me throw really quickly over to you, Curtis. This, again, is one of those things where the theory has to meet real world. And if you are demanding something in real world that is probably not going to happen, then why do you even call it a best practice? We actually ran into this a lot in my organization. This whole idea of best practices can't just be quote unquote best practices. They have to be best reliable practices. Have you ever had a conversation about that on enterprise efficiency?
You know, we have, and it's interesting because, as you say, it really comes down to where the best practices come from. If best practices have been developed by those in the field who iterate on a problem over and over and over again until they figure out what works, then those tend to be best practices that really live up to the name. The places where best practices get sketchy are when they come from someone who is ankle deep in practice and up to their eyeballs in the theory. And in that case, you tend to get things where, as you say, it might be lovely in practice or in theory, but in practice, it simply won't work. So for me, there needs to be another term for the things that we develop out of a think tank or out of an academic group that doesn't have real world experience. Call it something, an aspirational guideline. Call it, to be honest, call it pie in the sky, wishful thinking about security and backup, but leave best practices for those things that have been developed by people who really went out and practiced in order to figure out what was best.
Thad, we're going to go back over to you. I've given you this time to think about your mythical network here. Now, this is the time where you can tout your product. I'd specifically like you to talk about the partnership between IOSafe and Synology and what you've created to help us in a situation like this. So, hand it over to you. What Qbert went through, knowing that a lot of their tapes actually got washed away with the flood, what kind of network could you suggest to something like a university research environment where they needed the 3-2-1 rule that's actually federally mandated? They needed fast access, and they also needed something that would be researcher tolerant. I think that's the polite way to say it.
Researcher tolerant and 10 terabytes is the limit?
Yeah, still? Let's talk about 10 terabytes.
Okay. Now, when we talk about 10 terabytes, are we talking about one volume, or is that 10 terabytes sliced up into different departments?
You tell me the way that you want it. I'm saying I need 10 usable terabytes of data, but that 10 terabytes needs to be duplicated. So, a total of 30 terabytes, actually.
Well, because if we're talking money is no limit, pie in the sky, Brian is already covering those bases. I would definitely get two of IOSafe's 1513 pluses, have one that is actively, close, nearline proximity to all of the people that are actually working on it. Another that's maybe someplace else on the campus that, is bolted down someplace as being used as a backup target, and then have a 1513 plus a 1513 plus someplace else, maybe in another, maybe not in Hawaii.
Okay.
Maybe someplace further away. I don't know, because, but I would have created a backup and pre-populated it so that the initial synchronization wasn't a factor. If we're bringing the cost down quite a bit, which is perfectly reasonable, and if we're not talking single volume usage, then a 1513 plus or a DS1513 plus backing up to external USB devices would be fine locally. And, if it is maybe not the most cost-effective way to go, but a service like Amazon Glacier, for instance, I think it's $100 for 10 terabytes, $100 a month. And over time, that could end up costing quite a bit of money, but that certainly is an option if the anxiety is sort of rooted around actually having physical drives in two physical locations. But it, I mean, again, if money were no object, I would do it all with the 50 and 13 pluses, because they're heavy, they're wonderfully designed, and they are in every sense a DS 15 13 plus, but in a fireproof, waterproof enclosure. I mean, there will even be expansion units for it so that you can actually grow your volume into 15 bays. So, I mean, it is, have that on a network with 802.11ad so you can do link aggregation and maximize the overall bandwidth that you have with the 4 gigabit NICs, and you actually have a very nice and serviceable utility for a lab environment.
Right. So you're talking about sort of a near line, far line, online backup. Well, you got a really good question from Cool Breeze in the chat room who wants to know, sure, if it's worth discussing the versioning of backup data. That's actually one of the things that I think bothers people the most. If like in this setup, we had nearline and farline, but they were still connected to the same high-speed network, just on, sure, different parts of the campus, that's easy. I mean, you can spare that kind of a bandwidth, and so you can do instant synchronization.
Right.
But let's say you used Amazon Glacier, where you're not going to get immediate backups. I mean, the synchronization is going to take time.
Right.
What mechanisms would you put into place to make sure that the versioning is not going to get out of control?
Well, I think in an environment like this, you would probably be dealing with iSCSI, LUNs, sort of logical unit numbers, sort of rationalized blocks of virtual data. Every data is virtual, so what I'm saying is redundant. Anyway, but rational blocks of data, and you can snapshot those LUNs and make very quick eidetic copies of the state of a system, you can sort of schedule it to go as quickly, as frequently as you want it to. And those can be relatively small in size, and they can be sort of brokered off towards times when bandwidth is not as in demand as the working hours. But then again, you are sort of talking about a latency effect not terribly different from having it be, say, in a cloud-based service.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure I have a great answer for that.
Actually, something else that I notice is there are torrent clients that I can run on my Synology boxes. We did have a question in the chat room earlier about, sure, what's the feasibility of designing some way of using torrents to increase your overall throughput? I mean, especially if you've got a lot of different boxes that are synchronizing across wide, vast areas of network, could that be a usable feature?
Well, as a matter of fact, we actually are aware of people that are using BitTorrent Sync with Synology boxes right now. It's not directly supported by us, but apparently it works, and it works very well. My big hope is now that we have APIs and developer toolkits available so that people can actually develop for the Synology platform, that maybe the BitTorrent Sync guys will actually develop a package that everyone can use. I mean, right now, there definitely is a way to deploy it, but again, it not being supported, it's just, if you ran into an issue, we couldn't help you with it. But it's very viable, and it is a very fast way of keeping large volume files synchronized. I mean, you can actually download like 10 gigabytes in under a half hour if you've got a good network connection. It seems pretty great idea to me.
Right.
Yeah, I can speak.
Don't worry about it. Cheever, let me throw back over to you. So knowing now what you went through, poking mud with broomsticks, maybe Jason can find a picture of that flood and show the good folks at home exactly what you had to do in order to recover backup data. But now that you know that, what kind of system would you like to have in place?
Actually, what I'd like to have in place is, I'm actually implementing for the Hawaii Natural Energy Institute, is we're actually going to have a Synology.
Oh, look, there's your server. I see it.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you can see it got kind of ground up. that's how big the water was. But anyway, I'm going to have a Synology 2014 Plus that We just awarded the bid. We're going to be purchasing. That's going to be doing the high-speed local backups. And then we're going to actually use Glacier, and we're going to have Glacier do the off-site backup and pay the recurring charges on that.
Got it. And actually, Dan in the chat room, who is our chat room owner, he talks about how he just uses the unlimited version of CrashPlan. But I think the takeaway here is we all have our favorite bits. I'm actually a big fan of BitTorrent Sync. I also like using the nearline, farline methodology where I've got multiple disaster-resistant arrays on the same campus that are likely to survive a disaster to any single part of the campus. But what do you think? Let me throw this over to you, Curtis. Could we still use the 3-2-1 doctrine in a new era of backup where we have online storage, when we have disaster-resistant storage? Is that still the proper best practice to follow?
So far as we know, it is the best practice. And interestingly enough, it is of a piece with the data tiering that's going on in online storage, the storage that is active day-to-day. So the whole concept of having different tiers, different ages of storage is one that should translate very well from day-to-day operational storage into backup. Now, I'll admit, I am a little bit less wonderful at the three-tier backup because I do have multiple ongoing backups. You know, I have an on-site backup that is constant, and then I have two levels of off-site backup at work. I'm a very paranoid man about my data. But the nice thing is that the three-tier storage, while it strikes some people as being too much overhead in terms of personnel time or physical resources in terms of tapes or disks, we know that it works. We know why it works, and we know how it works. There's a lot to be said for having one area of your IT operation where you can simply follow the recipe and be reasonably assured that you're getting it right. The three-tier backup plan does a good job at that.
Well, gentlemen, we are at the end of our hour. What I'd like to do is do one more round of the panel. And just quickly, what would be your takeaway? If you were talking to a young administrator, let's say a small to medium business owner, what would you tell him? What are the things that he needs to know about disaster preparedness? And let's start with you, Thad. What are the things that you would want him to do?
I would want him to have at least a backup. At the very minimum, have a backup, because I think we know statistically that something like 60% of businesses that suffer data loss don't recover again. So just having one level of safety is, you know, mitigating an awful lot of disaster. And then barring that, having an offsite location would also be great. But just having backup, that's a place to start.
Got it. Chibert, what about you? What's your takeaway?
Data doesn't exist if it doesn't exist in at least three places.
Actually, that's nice and succinct. Okay, good. We've got the moment of zen from Chibert. And what about you, Curtis? So let's a little higher level. Let's say you're trying to convince an executive that he needs to pony up a little bit more money because the first time you have a disaster, your company is going away.
I think that's a good thing, and there are examples. Hey, backup is the cheapest insurance check you're going to write this year. You have no trouble insuring your office space. You have no trouble insuring your inventory. You have no trouble insuring the health and safety of your employees. Data needs to be on that list, too, and trust me, the check you write to insure that data is far smaller than the check you're going to end up writing if things go south in a big way.
Gentlemen, you are all filled with wisdom. I want to take you home and keep you in my data closet, but that sounds weird, so we're not going to do that. I want to thank you all for being part of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We can't have the show without the wisdom, the experience that you folks bring in. Let's start with you, Thad. If people wanted to find out what you're doing, what Synology is doing, what IOSafe is doing, where should they go?
Well, certainly. Synology.com, S-Y-N-O-L-O-G-Y.com. And, of course, we're at Synology on Twitter. IOSAFE is I-O-S-A-F-E.com, obviously. And they're doing some pretty amazing things. I would very much recommend people go check out what they're doing.
Thad Weil from Synology, really, go check out their stuff. We've been big fans here on the show. Chibert, let's go to you. If people wanted to know what you were doing with, what was that, the 3D Magna something thing, where should they go?
Well, I'm going to be probably writing some articles on 3D printers in the near future. I'm not sure who it's going to be for. Maybe Tom's Hardware. Maybe we'll do something else. We might even be able to go and do something interesting for your one of the Twitch shows.
Ooh,
because I'm going to be taking the dodecahedron speakers, and I'm going to be showing people how to amplify your sound over a very large area, big football field or bigger, and not have to worry about out-of-phase sound from all the different speakers.
This is going to involve a lot of math, isn't it? Because I was told there wouldn't be a test.
No, actually, the math is pretty simple. And thank you very much to the Internet 2 for their wonderful open-source software called OWAMP, which allows you to accurately measure one-way latency.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chibert. And Curtis, my favorite host from Enterprise Efficiency. Sir, every week that you're on is just a little brighter. Can you tell me what's going on over in your neck of the woods?
Well, Padre, actually some big things are happening. I can't talk about all of them, but trust me, probably on next week's Twiet, we're going to have some big news about things around Enterprise Efficiency. I think it's going to mean great things for everyone. Stay tuned for further information on this one. It's not quite the season ender, but you're going to want to stay tuned.
Wow, everyone has like super secret announcements they can't talk about except me. I'm feeling kind of left out. But I do want to say thank you. Thank you to the three of you. Thank you for being part of the show. And thank you for helping us figure out what best practices mean for disaster recovery. Now, I also want to thank you. That's right, our loyal audience member, whether you watch it, whether you listen to it, whatever it may be, we want to thank you for being so loyal to This Week in Enterprise Tech. We're almost up to 100 episodes, and that just means we've been doing this a really long time. Now, for that, we want to give you something. We want to give you a way to get our show automatically into your device of choice. Simply go over to our show page at twit.tv/twiet, and you'll find a little drop-down menu near the top that will automatically subscribe you to the RSS feed of choice. Do you want the audio version for your drive home? You can get that. You want a video version for your iPad or, let's say, your Android tablet? We can give you that, too. Do you want the full high-definition version that you can watch on your PC, Mac, desktop, whatever it might be? Well, yeah, we'll give you that. It's all part of the love that we show to the Twit Army. Also, please follow us on YouTube at youtube.com/Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. That's the initials. And there you'll find all the different ways that we break out the individual segments of the show. It's, again, part of the love that we give to the Twiet Riot. Also, follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll be able to find out what we're doing each week before we actually do the show. Plus, you'll be able to suggest possible topics for future episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Also, yeah, you can actually see my my Beats headphones there. Go ahead and subscribe, and you can buy the latest pair of Beats by Padre, the lowest bass response you'll ever find in a set of headphones. Ever. You can also find us live here every Monday. We do this show in the Brick House at live.twit.tv, 2:30 p.m. Pacific time. And as long as you're there, why not join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv? You'll get to converse with some brilliant engineers, with some funny trolls, and just some people who make Twit such a special place. I also want to thank everyone who made this show possible, to Leo, to Lisa, to Carson, my super producer, and of course, to Jason Howell, my super TD, who, Jason, you want to tell the folks about a show that just might save their lives?
That's a secret that I'm planning to unveil at, well, you were just saying that everybody has a secret except me.
Exactly.
This is the only one that I got. I don't have any secrets. In fact, it's all out on the table. You can check out All Bad Android at twit.tv/AAA. Every Tuesday is a new episode. Be there.
By the way, one of the best shows on Twit TV, I'd say. Yeah.
Wow. Thank you.
I know. I mean, really? Right? You feel the love. Y'all feel the love, people. And that's it. Thank you very much for watching. I'm Father Robert Ballister, and I just want to remind you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.